Tuesday, June 28th, 2017. I'd like to call to order today's exciting meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education. Thank you all for joining me. Yes, they're all exciting. Higher education, Senator Thompson. One of our priorities. One of our exciting priorities. I would next like to open a work session on Senate Bill 5524, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and ask Doug Wilson to enlighten us.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I'm already tired, so this will take a while to go through. You should have the documents. I'm looking at the LFO recommendation document. We'll jump around a little bit on it, how it's structured, but we'll keep that to a minimum. This is the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. It is a rather large budget. Our recommendation is for $1.9 billion, $2.4 million. Total funds, staffing at 122 positions and 115.24 FTE. We spent a number of days going through the HEC budget and its programs. Real briefly, it was established in 2011 by the legislature in Senate Bill 242, further refined in 2012. Its major areas of responsibilities, developing goals and maintain accountability, measures for the post-secondary system, approve and authorize degree programs at both public universities and community colleges, administer the private education, the Office of Degree Authorization and Private School Program. They administer workforce programs, and that staff works closely with the Employment Department staff. They provide financial assistance through post-secondary students through the Oregon Opportunity Grant, the Oregon Promise Program, and some smaller programs that the OSAC administers. They distribute, which was most of the funding in their budget, to the general support to public universities, community colleges, and OHSU, Oregon Health Sciences University, and they also manage the debt service for quite a few state-issued bonds, which is a growing responsibility and amount in their budget. The numbers will look a little funny because 15-17 was the first year that they really came into being as a full-fledged agency. Before that, we had separate agencies with Community College and Workforce Development, the old Oregon University System, OSAC, or the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, which is now OSAC, is the Office of Student Access and Completion. I got to make sure I get this right. So there were a number of things that came together to create this department. The CSL for the commission, their budget was just under $1.872 billion general fund, just under $77 million in lottery funds, and a little bit over $2.324 billion of total funds. In terms of major features in this budget, the public university system support fund is increased by $43.6 million, or almost 6.3 over current service level. The community college support fund is increased by a little over $7 million general fund, or just a bit over 1% over CSL. Funding for the opportunity grant is maintained at current service level of roughly $146 million. And Oregon Promise in this bill is funded at $35 million. When we get to that, I want to talk a little bit more about, or have some of the members on the work group that met yesterday talk for a few seconds about what they came out with. And then finally, the outdoor school, ballot measure 99, is funded at $24 million. And that is in the budget of the Extension Service. That represents the first 2 years of the state-funded outdoor school program, continuing programs that had been funded by school district-own resources or fundraising activities and foundation funding. I should note that the funding for most of the debt service for OHSU will be in another bill. It will probably run through capital construction. But that will be in the Department of Administrative Services through their budget, not here. So now I would like to move, if you go forward a few pages and walk through this document, which is part of that memo, starts about 6-7 pages back.
I'm sure. Mr. Wilson, I need to catch up. Which meeting material are we on?
I think it's called LFO Recommendation 5524.
Yeah.
Got it. It will be challenging to read what Doug is about to go over online because I think the pages are sideways.
Let me
look. Oh, no, they are. Look at that.
They're right.
An effort to.
They're small.
Turn over.
I mean,
they're
the small, print is small,
but they are.
You can thank Michael for that.
So where am I going?
Thank
Keep
you,
going
Michael.
Down. There's an extra blank page in there. Just the
It's page 1 of 42.
There
yes.
it is.
There it is. Okay.
Everybody
so
up,
this
up
is, you'll see a cover page for each of the major budget areas in this budget. Because of sort of the broad scope it has, there's going to be a lot of these sort of separate budget areas. So the first page there, 1 of 40, is the summary for the entire agency. So what you'll see there is where it was in 15-17, how it progresses through the building of the current service level budget, and then the adjustments in our recommended packages, finally ending at the 17-19 legislative actions, which is the legislative adopted budget at this stage.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wilson, what part of the lottery fund or legislation designates $96 million of lottery funds to the HEC?
$24 million of that would be the outdoor school, and then there are significant amounts of debt service, Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, in the public university system in the community.
We're using it for bonding.
For paying back bonds.
But it's not cash for
no.
except for the outdoor school.
Yeah, well, cash, I mean, it's cash in the sense of paying debt service.
Yeah.
But.
Thank you.
So if you turn the page to page 2, this is the operations cover page. I should note that since this is a newer agency, the orbits on each individual section of the budget at the top of the page isn't filled in. That's a systems issue. You'll see that next year that will be filled. So I'm on page, moving on to the different policy packages. On page 3 of 40, there's a package 109, which does some reclasses of three positions based on desk audits and been approved by Department of Administrative Services, Human Resources folks, and funding for one of the positions is shifted from general to other funds, producing about $150,000 of general fund savings. The next package, package 801 on page 4, this package is a reduction of $200,000 in vacancy savings. So as you build the budget, we assume a certain level of vacancy savings. This recommendation is to take $200,000 more of vacancy savings. It means the agency is going to have to closely follow their hiring process to meet this reduction, and there'll likely be another one coming in the end of session bill. Keep in mind that the governor also has put into a hiring slowdown into place around across state government. Package 802, this is page 5. Unfortunately, I do not remember the bill number right now, but it transfers the Talent Council, which is a relatively new entity that was in the Employment Department as a separate council. The decision was made to transfer $1 million worth of its funding from Employment Department and sort of fold the Talent Council in with the existing Workforce Investment Council at the state level. And so this package is one half of that $1 million. It is for one position, 1.05 FTE, but it's likely that they're going to fill in part-time positions to full-time to staff this and maybe hire just one person, but spread quite a bit of it over existing positions. Also included are resources to pay sort of the closeout cost of the former talent council at the employment department. There would have to be an interagency agreement for that. There is also another $500,000 in later in the budget in the workforce program for the actual talent grants. The last package in operations is a vacant position elimination. You'll see this if you've been in other subcommittees. You've probably seen it often for this budget as well as the ODE budget, which you'll see in a couple days. We've taken a close look at vacancy positions, talked with the agency about what other positions might be have been vacant for a while they'd like to replace, and the department came and we worked together to come up with five positions to abolish, 4.3 FTE. Most of them were empty positions in the workforce programs. So the savings, the general fund savings there is $746,000 and about $971,000 total funds.
Mr.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Wilson, does that include their benefits? Is that strictly salary?
No, Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, that would include benefits, in some cases S&S costs that are connected to the position.
Thank you.
So that is the operations, which is the vast majority of the staffing in HEC. Moving on to support to community colleges, this is the general support through the community college support fund that is distributed out via a formula to the 17 community colleges across the state. On page 8, there's package 1801. These are adjustments. In this case, funding for the two skills centers is reduced by 10%, or roughly $63,000. And then these two skills centers, and they're the only two in the state that are funded, are the Sabin Professional Technical Center in Milwaukee and the Margaret Carter Skills Center at PCC in Portland. So Portland Community College, excuse me. Also, this package is about a $2.1 million general fund reduction for a one-time related startup funding for programs in high-demand STEM areas, health sciences, engineering, high-tech, manufacturing, precision agriculture, and other areas. So overall, this is a $2.13 million reduction package. Then in 802 is an enhancement or an addition to the Community College Support Fund. This is a $6.4 million increase in the General Support Fund, bringing it up to just over $570 million general fund. This represents roughly a 1.1% increase in the current service level. The intent of this was to offset increases in tuition over the next 2 years at community colleges.
Senator Roblin.
So when we do current service levels for the community colleges and others, do we include in our working out those levels the cost of insurance and the cost of PERS to them, or do we are those numbers excluded in the cost of living increase that they get?
We Madam Chair, Senator Roblin, we use information that they collect from the community college and factor in some of the benefit costs like we do with the state school fund, and we also factor in property taxes. And one reason this particular one hasn't gone up, current service level, was an increase in property taxes proportionally greater than the growth in cost. So this did not go up as much. Okay. Now, in terms of the public universities, this year we did calculate a sort of two sets of, or two CSL levels, but the second one, which did factor in more of the benefits, sort of got lost, but it's pretty much covered by the additions to the public university. In the future, we plan to use a calculation similar to the community colleges for the public university, so it factors in the benefits more.
because we have required them to be a part of those systems, I would hope that we would use that in CSL. And I know for things like the extension services and some of those other stuff, we have not used that. Is that correct?
We have not, but we will. It was calculated this time, and we'll start calculating as a single current service level
for
the 1921 budget.
Okay. I just wanted to hear
all that. Senator Monroe.
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I was, troubled by the fact that the increase for community colleges was so much lower than the increase for universities. But then we did our work yesterday on the Oregon Promise. And even though the Oregon Promise funds don't go directly to the community colleges, they certainly do benefit community colleges, and there'll be $40 million total in the Oregon Promise. So I feel a little more comfortable with the disparity, even though I did lobby the big co-chairs pretty hard, and I lost that battle to try and get the community college up closer to equal with the universities.
Okay.
Oregon Promise does help balance that, even though those dollars go to students, they don't go directly to the community colleges.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I would like to, after the Wisani die and Mr. Wilson's had his relief and rest and recuperation, that I'd like to see, and I'm not going to ask for it before we vote on the budget, but remember we had the slide by the four-year universities on cost drivers and how much salaries had gone up, how much health insurance had gone up, and how much PERS had gone up. Because I just would appreciate maybe if you'd endorse it that we could get Mr. Wilson to provide us those cost drivers after he rests and recuperates.
I'll work with the universities and
for the heck, thank you.
Go ahead.
So moving on, we talked about the $6.4 million increase in to the Community College Support Fund. Also in this budget is about $3.1 million for funding for assisting first generation and underserved students. This is within the current service level. It continues. It derives from House Bill 3063 from either the 13th session or the 15th session. But it's really benefiting sort of first-generation college-going or post-secondary-going students. That completes the support to community colleges. Moving on to public universities, their general support, which is in the public university operations and student support. On page 11 is package 801. This eliminates funding for something that was added last year, $570,000 worth of savings from the career advising and mentorship pilot project. It was a pilot project at two public universities, Western and Oregon State University, and it was used primarily for people to help work with students to bring together alumni and others to set up career mentoring for students. It was the decision of the co-chairs to not include that in the budget since it was a pilot project and really short its general fund also. Package 802 is a program enhancement. It provides $44.1 million increase over service levels for the public universities. It represents a 6.4% increase over current service level and brings the support fund payments up to just under $737 million. And it again is also the expectation is that these funds, additional funds, will be used to offset tuition increases and therefore the budget note that you see there. Keep in mind that public universities are required to come before the commission, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission itself, if their tuition is over 5%. They produced some very good data showing if amount was added over the governor's recommended amount for this these payments, that it would every, I think it was $20 million increments, if I remember right, that they would lower their tuition by so much. We looked at that and came up with those five of the seven universities that were over 5%, what the suggested increase would be based on these additional funds. Those are in front of you there by institution. I apologize, the formatting in this budget system sometimes gets a little wacky, and it's a little hard to change. So there's not enough spaces between some of these. And then for the second year, this budget note, the expectation is that no public university's resident undergrad tuition growth shall exceed 5%. Now, if my assumption would be that if universities would see having trouble with that, they would come back and sort of report to the 2018 legislature about that.
Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Is that University of Oregon at 56%?
I looked at it really closely. Oh, it's 6.56.
Yes, it's 6.56.
Okay. Somebody's dyslexic.
I had the same thing.
Somebody's dyslexic.
I had to get really close.
Turn
no, there's another number right in front of there. You just can't see it. You have to get really close to see
it
the
is,
six.
It is.
Oh,
it's,
I see.
And yeah. I said it okay. set at that amount after some discussions with University of Oregon.
Now
and
I see it.
I do need to note and thank the University of Oregon lobbyists for pointing out that we needed to add the term
like
resident undergraduate tuition increase. So this is for the resident undergrad tuition, which I think most people think about as looking at this.
Representative Lively.
So, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So just for clarification, so for those institutions of higher education that didn't have recommended tuition increases above 5%, they still get their proportionate share of this increase.
Oh, yes, they do.
But it doesn't. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank
but
you.
They don't have to adjust.
They
there.
Don't have to adjust. Yeah, thank you.
But they're sure free to.
Yeah. Right.
Moving on to the public university state programs, and we'll come back and later in the work session on the budget note for approval. Formal approval. Public university state programs, these are those various, I think there are 13 of them. There'll probably be more by the end of session because this is where, if you come in with special appropriations for various things, this is where they get stuck in the budget. These are about just under $40 million. And then on the next page, on page 14, there are increases of just over just under $200,000 that was provided, and it is spread across. So the final funding spread across those programs, again in a hard to read format, is for the 13 programs is listed there.
All right.
Senator Roblin.
Just to make a couple comments on that, because I agree that there are some other things that are added. In the last biennium, DLCD funded the program that we have on collaboration, Oregon Consensus, in respect to Eastern Oregon and the sage grouse. And I'm not seeing it here. It's about $400,000. They've moved it into HEC, but the money didn't move, just the program. And I hope that as we look at the Christmas tree budget that we make sure, because the stuff that they have been doing on sage grouse in Eastern Oregon is really important, and everybody that I know that's over there wants that to continue because it's important for not getting listing. And I just want to make sure we point it out, and this is the part of the budget where I think that needs to go. Gene's over there more than I am, but I've heard from my cattleman. I have from everybody on this one.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Roblin. I didn't see that that came up, but yes, it's actually a court ruling that they have to keep together and find a solution. So I appreciate identifying that and hope that leadership will be sure that's funded. It's important for the people working and the people wanting to protect the stage grounds. So.
Yep.
Senator Roblin.
And as I look through the budget, we had a bill in for I think it was around $9 million to bring up the statewides to what we thought they were before, and I think this budget reflects about $7.6 million for that same amount of additions. And this is the place where I really felt that the fact that we don't include in our CSL the idea of insurance costs and other kinds of things showed up the most, and I don't know if that was the case or not in this one, but it looked like it a little bit to me, and I would rather get that funding continue to have it up there because those statewide programs are really important from the perspective of us in rural areas, but I think it's also important for other people. And so I want to mention those. And yes. The other one that I have consistently talked about trying to get in here that doesn't seem to show up all the time, and we've never really given it any money, is the program down at OIT, as all what I keep calling it, that has to do with their ORIC program that they have that they keep doing, and yeah. It has never been funded. I would hope that we would continue to look at making sure that there is some funding for that program in the future, and I didn't necessarily see it in here. So it's a great program. It's working really well, but we need to start helping with that one, in my opinion. So
I think it's the bills.
Just thought I'd mention that.
The ORIC thing? Yeah, that had some bills.
Okay.
I don't know why. Continue on to the Ag Experiment Station. One of the statewides.
Yep.
Their budget is just over $66 million, and like the state programs, there is an increase, it's a proportional increase of just about 0.5% over CSL, and that adds $323,000 to their the budget there. That's on page 16. The extension service, their cover page is on page 17, and a similar increase, again on package 802, is made, in this case, $233,000, and representing about a 0.5% increase over CSL. Also in this package, the $24 million of lottery funds are added for the outdoor school. This represents about, I think, just under... About 56% of the roughly $44 million that the ballot measure called for. I think some of the thinking about the amount of this one is it does have to get started. I think that it will need to be ramped up. It is not a statewide program now. The funding here, based on some information I got from the Extension Service and some of their partners in this, would be that serve about 45% of the target population, which is fifth and sixth graders, in the first school year, and about 65% in the second year. So it is ramping up. And then there's also the Extension Service is allowed to keep up to 15% for admin, but they are probably going to spend significantly less than that 15% in their planning. So and these costs go for sort of the outdoor school programming, the transportation, the room and board, and then stipends to the classroom teacher over and above the salary that the district is paying them, since they're going to the outdoor school and spending much more than just the school day.
Senator Roblin.
You know, we had a great hearing here in which the Gray Foundation came and talked about all and money they've been putting in ahead of time to get it ramped up and ready to go. I think that this fund will probably not meet the needs of the number of schools that are ready to go and the programs that are out there. So I hope we watch this during the interim, come back possibly. If more kids and more schools are able to participate earlier than was anticipated by this, that we watch that closely, personally.
Thank you. Senator Monroe?
Yeah, and like Senator Roblin, I'm a big fan of the outdoor school program, and I lobbied to get that 24 up to 30. I lost that battle. Seems
Can't
like that's all. Happening.
You haven't done very well.
Well, I know. I am hoping that, we'll have outdoor school by the next biennia, we'll have it universal all across the state, which is the intent of ballot measure 99.
Thank you, Senator. Anybody else? Okay.
Okay, continue on to the Forest Research Lab, the final of the statewides. Their budget is approximately $10.2 million general fund. There's a similar package, 802 on page 20, that increases by just under $50,000, and this is a 0.5% increase over CSL, proportionally the same size as the other three programs that are represented here as statewide for the public university system and the public service or the public university state programs. So that takes care of the what used to be called OUS or the public universities. The next budget is the Oregon Health Sciences University programs. These are the assistance that the state pays the medical, nursing, dental schools, as well as the rural health and the area health care. I can't remember the name completely of it up there at the public university or at the OHSU, along with the Poison Center, as well as the Child Rehab and Development unit or institution up there. Overall, there's $77.3 million in this budget. Package 802 on page 22. Last session in 2015, House Bill 3396 passed. This program or this bill consolidated a number of the health care provider incentive programs, financial assistance programs, and two of these programs were located at OHSU. It would have, in developing a current service level, it was assumed by DAS that 75% of the dollars needed to flow to the Oregon Health Authority, where this new group was established. But because of the nature of the two OHSU programs, they've already committed the first year, 12-month school year, of funds. So we're moving a quarter of the funds back into their budget. So for those two programs, the Healthy Scholars Program and the Loan Forgiveness Program, they'll have half their funding in OHSU's budget for the first year, and then it will be half of it will be in the OHA budget under this new program. And so this represents bringing a quarter of the total funds back into OHSU. The next area is student assistance. The primary programs in here are the Oregon Opportunity Grant, which is basically at current service level in this budget. I should note that we may very well be adjusting it, the Oregon Opportunity Grant, in the end of session bill as we balance out lottery and general fund issues, which is one of the last things that we'll put together. So in terms of student assistance, on page 24, there is sort of two packages here on Oregon Promise. This is the first one.
Doug.
Yeah.
So what's the opportunity?
What's the opportunity grant number?
146.1 million, I think.
146.1
million. You won't see it on these documents, but you will see. We'll make sure it's in the budget report.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
146. Okay. Thank you.
So package 106 is the sort of the first step in Oregon Promise. Keep in mind, up until you pass Senate Bill 55 early in session, for 15-17, there was a $10 million annual cap on Oregon Promise. So this is the first package that gets you up to just under $40 million. Then, so it adds 19.8, which is the programming side of it. That means that the $10 million annual dollar cap is still in place for future biennia. And you heard Senate Bill 1032 a few days ago. That bill will probably move either in the subcommittee or the Capital Construction Committee, and it will take off the 10% caps, make a few other small program changes. And then in relation to Package 801, it will provide additional flexibility to the to HEC to institute any reductions that have to take place because of the funding level. So Package 801 reduces, as a placeholder in this case, $5 million from the Oregon program or Oregon Promise program, leaving just under $35 million in this budget. But I do need to state that there is another $5.3 million that will be in the end of session bill. So when you gather all that together, you got just under $40 million in Oregon Promise dollars. Now, there was a work group that met yesterday. Three members of this subcommittee were on that work group. I'll let them chime in if they would wish to say sort of the results of that work group. Or I can do it.
Why don't you do it, Doug?
Okay. So they were presented basically three options or three groups of options by the Higher Education Commission, Coordinating Commission staff, and they chose what we called Model 3, which would then, and help me here with the details as I forgot to bring the chart in, it would protect throughout the biennium the class, that cohort that has always already been in the system for this school, this current school year, the one that just ended. And then starting with those students that would start in the fall and into the future, the there would be really what is essentially a means test based on earned family contribution, which is something you fill out if you have kids in college like I did for years. You kept filling out this long, not so complicated form, and it generated an earned family contribution. And it is not a level, it's based on income, but it's not just based on income. It's also based on other factors, assets, and the number of dependents that you have in college. So
it's a number that comes from the FAFSA form, the federal aid.
Right.
So it is the standard. You come up with expected family contribution, and it's the standard not only for the Oregon Promise, but for all college financial aid situations. So it's consistent. It is consistently what is used all across. So what we proposed was, in order to try to maximize the program without maximizing the costs, was to do a flexible cap on the expected family contribution, with the goal of, depending on the number of students that we get, having it be as high as possible so we can get as many kids in as possible while still holding to the about $10 million a year, holding the first class harmless, and also the full, didn't we agree to the full time as well? To change it to full time? Yeah.
You want me to
Sure.
take it off?
Senator Monroe.
There were a number of things we discussed. One was, and I think the committee would have preferred to go to a full-time at 15 quarter hours, which is full-time. We're currently at 12. The reason we decided not to go to 15 at this time is because the federal government only funds up to 12. And if we went to 15, the state would have to pick up the entire cost of the additional 3 credit hours. So philosophically, I think everybody on the committee would have preferred to go to 15, but until either the feds change or we get more money, it really wasn't practical at this time. The other decision that we had some discussion on was the $50 copay. And there was some who perhaps suggested we might want to go to 100, and there are other advocates who want to eliminate it entirely, go to 0. So we decided to keep it at 50 where it is. And that was the decision there. Our actions were based upon wanting to, A, preserve Oregon Promise, make sure it continues and it's successful, and also leave us with flexibility in terms of the enrollment. It's attracted way more students than we originally budgeted for, which is a good thing, but it costs more. And so we wanted to leave the flexibility when we get the September numbers of the second year's enrollment to make adjustments if necessary, up or down, based on what that enrollment is. We think that enrollment is liable to be even higher. So we wanted to leave the flexibility so that we protect the program. If we had chosen one of the other options, most of us on the subcommittee, or maybe all of us, felt like Oregon Promise might be in jeopardy, and we wanted to make sure that it was protected. So subcommittee worked for a couple of hours yesterday afternoon and came up with the recommendation, and Representative Wisnett and both of us co-chairs were on that subcommittee.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And both co-chairs, I think, did a good job of reflecting what the discussion was. And everyone agreed keeping it operational and not risking losing the program as a top priority. I think it's also important, however, I came into the meeting, thought I was going to look for another $4 million or $8 million but that was not our charter from the leadership. It was to find how to keep the program alive within the $40 million. So that's what we had to work within, and I endorse and support this program that we came up with.
Thank you. Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and thanks for the work on this. I appreciate the efforts that went into looking at how we sustain the program. So the question I have, and I'm sure I've been told this before, but so that first cohort, as long as they're a student in good standing, they don't have to reapply, and it just continues through their 2 years?
That's correct.
I'm getting mixed head movements from the audience. So, Bob, do you mind? Could you come up and give us a quick answer, or Ben?
Come on up, Bob, in case I get anything wrong. Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. So the question was whether second-year students, continuing students, have to reapply for the program. The answer is that they continue to be eligible for the program as long as they remain in good standing, meet the other criteria for the program. The proposal, as I understand it, coming out of the work group, is to grandfather in those students so they will not be subject to the eligibility changes, namely the means testing. In terms of a program application, they are required to submit an online application annually as well as their FAFSA, which really constitutes the heart of that application. So students do have some paperwork to process annually in order to remain eligible and receive grants under the program.
How did he do, Bob?
Great.
Oh, he's your boss.
For the record, Bob Brew, Deputy Executive Director. Really, we just require the application so the community colleges know who's likely to show up.
Great. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Representative Parrish.
So we don't have an amendment for the 1032 yet, so
no.
This is just sort of rhetorical until
correct.
It's drafted. And then, and where did you set the means test piece?
About 100,000 family income.
The equivalent of about, and we left it with some, where I know they're drafting it with some flexibility, because the idea is that we want to maximize the number of students who can receive it.
So is that gross income, or is that AGI, or what's the
That is
value?
The EFC from the FAFSA form. So the FAFSA form, which the Federal Financial Aid, do one of you want to take this?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, Representative Parrish. So yes, we predict, our expectation is that the legislation will not establish in law a precise EFC cap, but that the based on our modeling, if we're given the flexibility and the requirement to set an EFC cap in order to manage the dollars, we'll be setting it at around $18,000 expected family contribution. That equates to an average AGI of around $100,000. Now, as the member said, AGI does not map one-to-one to expected family contribution. It's not an exact match because of the incorporation of the number of dependents in college, assets other than income. But roughly speaking, an $18,000 expected family contribution for a typical family household would mean an AGI of around $100,000.
Okay. Senator Roblin.
So we have heard reasons our program is succeeding at the rate it is these courses that we added that are required of all the kids, and that we helped fund that last time because we had some extra money. Are we funding it at all this time, or are we hoping that the community colleges will continue to have that entry course for all these kids?
I would say we are continue to work on that,
okay.
Both encouraging the community colleges, because some of the setup was the idea for them to establish it and have it be ongoing, as well as there is continued encouragement that we can perhaps push a little more support their way.
I'm happy that you're having that encouragement.
Great. Representative Parrish.
I do actually have a different follow-up question. Is it related to something else? There was the pilot program from the Senate Bill 860 2 years ago. Two of the colleges got dollars for career and mentoring. Mm-hmm. Were those dollars were not given to community colleges or the seven universities, so that's not impacted in
correct
dollars going into helping the Oregon Promise kids at all.
Representative Parrish, co-chairs, if I understand the question, the elimination of the career mentoring funding affects programs and staffing at two public universities, but there's no relationship between that investment and community colleges or Oregon Promise dollars.
Okay, I just want to make sure that wasn't getting cut from
a
community college.
Okay. Moving on.
That completes
the
student assistance portion of the budget. If we move on to workforce and other special payments, this represents about $8.1 million in our recommendation. General fund, most of the funds for workforce programs come from the federal government, and you see roughly just under $100 million coming from them that will be spent in part of these programs. The additional packages under here, there's a package 070, which is a revenue shortfall package, and it's just sort of truing up what expected revenues are going to be, and in this case, it's about a $20,000 reduction, relatively small. Package 801, in terms of adjustments here, this is a 10% reduction in the general fund workforce programs. These program or these dollars go to fund industry sector strategies, local competitiveness strategies, and back to work, which is an on the job training program. This represents a 10% cut, and we'll leave it to the agency, who is probably best qualified to determine what programs and how much and where the cuts should take place. Those three areas are described there in the Orbitz report. Package 802, an enhancement. This is the other half of the talent count.
Sorry.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So the question I have, so I appreciate these are very important programs since I've worked for years with them. I'm just trying to understand if there's any relationship, though, to our reducing our general fund and how much federal funds. Is there any link between the amount of federal funds that arrive versus what investment we make?
Madam Chair, Representative Lively, one of the programs, the Back to Work Oregon, has a one federal match. So there is some impact, but the bulk of the funding that comes from the federal government is more of a block grant type funding.
Thank you.
Package 802 is the other half of the Talent Council. This is the $500,000 that are for the grants. These are talent grants, prepare students and current workers to be productive in the priority occupations and deliver innovative and cost-effective education and training models. I did not come up with that. I copied it off.
Yeah, I love the way you read that, Doug.
So they anticipate anywhere from 2 to 6 grants based on a number of factors. And there is a related package that we've already seen. And that concludes the workforce.
Okay. Any further questions about that? Senator Rowland?
No, I just want to express my appreciation for the clarity of that number, 500,000. So many of them have these other little dangling little numbers. And
no rounding.
That one is
there.
Right there, and I appreciate
Amen.
That.
I'm going on to the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps. There are no changes to their current service level, so you don't see any policy packages. This is on page 30. There is no general fund or lottery funds. This is an other funded program or a federally funded program, and this is the only other place where there's actually staff other than operations, and there are three positions here. No changes in any of the dollar or position numbers for that. The next one is the sports lottery on page 31. The policy package on page 32 reduces the sports lottery fund for what's sort of designated in statute and decreases it back to the level that it was in the 15-17 biennium, which is a reduction of just about $4.1 million down to $8,240,000. You see the distribution between the campuses for this program on page 32. It should be noted that both OSU and U of O are set numbers and proportionally look small. That one reason for that is they have access to quite a few bit more TV revenues than the other campuses do through the Pac-12 and other places.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, on sports lottery, I'm just reminding people that except for the big universe, well, except for U of O and OSU, sports lottery is critical to maintaining especially Title IX women's sports and so on because they don't have access to big television revenue from, you know, having a high-powered football or basketball team on the air all the time. So this is really pretty critical, and it's the main funding source. So those people that suggested that this be cut or eliminated ran into a stone wall with your two co-chairs.
Representative Lively.
Just so I understand this correctly, so the, quote, reduction of the $4 million is what was recommended in somebody else. Was that in the governor's budget? So we're not, because we're staying at the current budget level.
The governor's budget, Madam Chair, Representative Lively, zeroed out sports lottery, actually.
Yeah.
Right. And the recommendation here is to maintain it where it is today with the same distribution.
Yeah. Thank you.
Madam Chair, going on to the public university's debt service on page 33, you'll just notice the growth even between 15-17 and 17-19. There is significant growth in public university debt service as well as community college debt service. The changes in this one, there's one policy package on page 34, package 801. There's an increase of $3.9 million in non-limited other funds. These are things that we don't limit. And these are related to F bonds, which are bonds that are, they are general obligation bonds, but they're financed or paid back through university-owned resources. We still authorize them, but they are sort of self-financed by the universities themselves. Also in this package is a $900,000 limitation increase as G and Q bonds, excuse me, which is what the state generally pays for. They'll sell the bonds, and some of those proceeds will stay in an account and earn investment earnings or interest. And what this $900,000 does is recognize that there are some, and there is a corresponding offset in the end of session bill that decreases the general fund to whatever investment earnings this up to $900,000 of limitation provides. Moving on then to community college debt service on pages 35 and 36, the same type of investment earnings related other funds limitation is on package 801, and again the end of session budget will, or end of session bill will, capture the general fund as an offset. There also will likely be other changes to both these debt service numbers in the end of session bill as the bonding and capital construction committee puts together the final numbers around bonding. But keep in mind, usually for university and community college projects, you issue the bonds late in the biennium, so you do not make interest payments in the biennium that you authorize them. It's something that's been done for years. And then finally, there's an OHSU debt service on page 37. There's no change here. This is a relatively small share of OHSU debt payments that the state pays or recognizes in their budget. This is something we call legacy debt. These are bonds that were issued a number of years ago, probably 20, 30-year bonds for a building. It's still paying debt service. And as I mentioned before, the majority of the debt service that the state pays or recognizes for OHSU is in will be in a separate budget that flows through DAS. That will include about $26 million for the Knight Cancer Institute, as well as roughly $30 million that are financed off the tobacco master settlement agreement stream of revenues for a set of buildings that were built around 2000, early parts of this century.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Wilson, you said how much for the Knight Cancer?
I believe it's $26 million roughly for this biennium.
Does that satisfy the match that they were asking the state for? Is that?
Well, this is actually the payments on the bonds themselves that the state issued. They issued roughly $200 million in bonds that we'll be making payments on for a number of years. And then, of course, that matched, help the match on the Knight family that right. gave quite a bit more. And then finally, you'll see two community college sort of segments of the budget, capital construction and community college capital construction, and for public universities there on page 38 and 39. In terms of the public universities, there's no change. You would expect this to see this in the capital construction bill. This number will increase again by a sizable amount as those projects are approved by the capital construction subcommittee. For community colleges, similar, but there is an actual, on page 40 of 40, a technical adjustment, and it extends the $1.5 $1 million limitation for a project at Lynn Benton Community Colleges. It's the Advanced Transportation Center. And that is extended for another year. The bonds were settled this past April, and it's thought that by the end of June 2019, at the end of this biennium, it should be a sufficient time to complete and close out the project. And, Madam Chair, that is sort of the detail of the budget walking through.
Okay.
So,
further questions or comments? Senator Roblin.
Just a comment. I believe in being a broken record at times. And so I just
want to. At times?
And so I just want to make sure that we continue to have a conversation about the Eastern Oregon Resolution Project that we need about $400,000 on. That, from my rough estimates, we're about $4 million short of what we were hoping to get for our statewides, and I think that may have an impact on them if we don't figure that out. I do appreciate what we've done, because I think that there's some really good work there, but would like to make sure we consider that and at least have a conversation with the big co-chairs about ORIC and the group down at OIT with regard to their projects that they've funded entirely through getting grants and stuff to this point. There comes a point when that stuff runs out, and I think if we want to continue that energy kind of project that they've been doing, it would be helpful that we have that conversation. So
I had just written that on
and
my list.
Thank you
as well.
For just want to make sure. Great, you got it all down. Senator. Didn't want to miss something, and I thank you very much for that. And I really appreciate the fact you're working on trying to find resources for the community colleges to add. Keep those programs alive that helped keep the 90% rate.
Right. Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I don't always agree with Senator Roblin.
Me neither.
I support what the Senator's proposing as far as statewide programs, but I think we really need to think in the future, Mr. Wilson and other leaders, that we look at those statewide programs individually at their outcomes and what we're doing. I don't think that I don't really appreciate voting on them as a group and giving money, additional money to them as a group. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay. Are we ready for motions?
Madam Co-Chair, I move LFO recommendation to Senate Bill 5524.
Senator Monroe has moved the LFO recommendation to Senate Bill 5524. Any discussion? Any objection? So moved.
So the next motion or next part of business are two budget notes. We talked about budget note number one, which had to do with public university tuition. There it's budget note number one, and it sets some limits on five of the public universities for the first year of the biennium and the expectation of 5% for all seven public universities. The second budget note deals with the Oregon Health Sciences University and the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education, and it calls for OHSU to work together with community colleges and stakeholders in the healthcare industry to report back to you in 2019 with an assessment of how the consortium is providing nursing education across the state to a diverse student population.
Great. Senator Monroe.
We're all concerned about tuition increases, high tuition increases. We've all been following the double digit, or in some cases nearly double digit tuition increases recommended. The additional money that we're putting in through this budget brings those down. I think the highest one now is about 6.5, and hopefully in the second year they'll be back down to 5. We're trying to hold tuition increases to under 5% or 5% or under per year. We're getting pretty close to it with this budget. We're not quite there, but it is a significant increase, a benefit to our students over what was initially recommended. Some of the universities was 9% or so. So I feel good about that. And Madam Co-Chair, I move LFO recommendation on the budget notes.
Senator Monroe has moved the LFO recommendation on the budget notes to Senate Bill 5524. Any further discussion? Any objection? So moved.
And key performance measures.
I will quickly go over them. They should be a separate document on OLIS. The HEC came in with basically a whole new set of sort of a makeover of their KPM system. Keep in mind, they're a relatively new agency, and they were sort of inherited a set of from all the other sort of component agencies when they combined. These are more of a concise set that they would like to present and have your approval on. They retain six of the existing ones, but off delete a whole set of them and replace them. A couple things. Many of them are measuring the same type of thing, but probably in a more manner which they can collect data and analyze better. It also increases the amount that they look at equity issues. So there's quite a few pairs of KPMs, like the first couple, that link or overall measure and then dive into various ethnic groups and how each of those are performing, dealing with affordability, graduation rates, certificate or completion of the community college in terms of certificates and A's or transfers. The one area that we do want to point out, though, is that there's still not a measure for workforce development, which is still a key area of the agency. We would suggest or recommend that they take a look at that and come back in the next budget cycle and maybe look at proposing one for them.
And Madam Co-Chair, I move a full recommendation on the key performance measures.
Senator Monroe has moved to accept the LFO recommendation on the key performance measures on key performance measures. Any discussion? I would just like to say in the discussion that this is the agency that I have certainly said privately, and I would like to say publicly, this is the little agency that could. We, as a body, ask a lot of this agency because they continue to deliver really excellent work across a wide area. And I just wanted to publicly say that in support of the KPMs and going forward, that just to really publicly acknowledge what great work the HEC has done and continues to do, and thank them for that. So that's my discussion before closing.
Madam Co-Chair.
Any objection? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
And because of that, we keep loading more responsibilities on them.
Yes. As we know, good behavior gets punished. Any objection? So moved.
And the -3 amendment?
Well, the next motion will be our recommended budget, which is listed by fund type, but it's reflected in the -3, not the A3. -3.
And Madam Co-Chair, I move adoption of the -3 amendments to 5524.
Senator Monroe has moved adoption of the -3 amendment to Senate Bill 5524. Discussion? Any objection? So moved.
And Madam Co-Chair, I move Senate Bill 5524 as amended to the full committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Monroe has moved Senate Bill 5524 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Parrish.
So I'm sitting here and I still don't know how I want to vote on this today. And because I think that there's some issues around the potential for cost to go up greater than what we're saying we're going to hold colleges to for pricing. You know, we keep hearing 3.4% will be the contained rates for PEB, but I'm just really not sure mechanically how that actually happens. And in looking through what we're actually spending on PEB and heard previous testimony from some of the university, you know, at least one university president who testified in front of us that that's not how much their healthcare rates are going up. I don't see, particularly in year two of this biennium, how this budget's going to actually allow us to hold tuition at 5%. I think that there are things that we left on the table around, particularly around the seven universities we'd like to be out of the PEB system. The CFO for my alma mater said, you know, that they believe that being out of PEB would save them $100 million. I mean, that is about the equivalent of a 5% tuition increase. And we failed to get that done. And so I really have a problem when we are cost shifting to students. And one of the bills that came out of this body is a 1.5% tax on PEB plans. So who's gonna pick up the tab for that? I don't see it reflected in this bill. Again, that will go to students. That will, you know, eventually eat that in a tuition increase. You know, I still have concerns about the Oregon Promise. I think I'm actually talking myself into a no vote here. I still have concerns about the Oregon Promise, and they're enough that I just don't think it's a promise if we can't actually afford to do it. And I think we're over-promising to the students of this state and not necessarily being able to back that up. I think there are ways to get kids into a higher ed, and we're seeing that, and I mentioned this on the floor during our education debate. We are seeing this in other states where they are blending K-12 and higher ed and using the same dollars to achieve the same goal, and we're saying, well, we have to fund this bucket, we have to fund this bucket, and we don't have enough in either bucket, instead of breaking down the walls between the buckets and just making a big giant swimming pool instead. So, yeah, I think I'm going to be a no today.
Okay.
I don't know, reserve my right to change that decision when it comes to the floor, but right now I think I still have enough concerns about passing these costs on to students year after year. You know, 20 years ago, I was in the Oregon student lobby when it had a different name than what it has now. And there's never been a year that students in this state have not come and said, we need more opportunity grant. We need a hold on freeze on tuition. We need a freeze on, you know, books and the cost of books going up. Housing's too expensive. We can't afford to live in the dorms. I mean, we're just continuing to make disinvestments, and we could make those investments with policy changes, and we're not doing that. So,
okay.
Thank you.
Further discussion?
Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
I'd like to give Mr. Cannon an opportunity to comment on this budget, because it's his budget before we actually vote on it.
Does he care to briefly, extremely briefly? We still have two more bills to get through this morning, colleagues.
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, for the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. There's a lot I could say and won't. I guess I'll, in just a nutshell, I think I speak for the agency and likely the higher education community in Oregon in recognizing that the state faces a very difficult budget environment. Statewide, your costs of funding current service level exceed your projected revenues. And yet this budget produces investments over and above the current service level. And I think that is a testament to this committee's support for higher education and workforce endeavors. At the same time, I think it must be said that this is not a funding plan for achieving the state's goals for certificate and degree completion and student success. I think you recognize that. Certainly our commission will recognize and continue to advocate for greater levels of state support for higher education and workforce in order to meet our ambitious goals. And, you know, the rising tuition costs, the need for greater levels of student support, I think, will continue to play out over the biennium to come, notwithstanding the, you know, the efforts that I appreciate this committee having made to bring those numbers up and do relatively well in the statewide context, the state budget context, but it is a very difficult state budget context.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, that will end the discussion on the movement of this bill. So any objection to the motion? Representative Parrish? So I don't think we need to take a roll call. We'll just note you as a no.
Fine.
Okay, so moved.
Carriers.
Carriers, would you like to go to the full and to the Senate?
Yes.
And as the co-chair, I'll go to the House. Okay. I'd like to close the work session on Senate Bill 5524 and open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2992. Thank you for your patience, Representative Noble. And someone else must be coming up, or maybe just Doug again.
Oh, Krista.
Okay. Uh-oh. We probably startled Krista.
Uh-oh. Can I? No, please.
Yeah, no. Can I have the representative testify, and then Krista
should,
can,
yes.
Please, Representative Noble, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe. Committee, this is actually hopefully much simpler than what you just did. We have a lot of safety issues in our schools over time. I had a chance, obviously, as law enforcement to work with schools. I had a chance to be a volunteer in schools as a coach, to speak in schools, and even work in some classrooms early on in my law enforcement career as a DARE officer. And each time, I went through a background check. We currently have a law that allows volunteers to be backgrounded. But to my surprise, we don't have a law that requires volunteers to be backgrounded. We require teachers, teachers' assistants, administrators, vendors, contractors. But volunteers who have direct unsupervised access with students are not right now required. This bill simply is to require that if a school district allows volunteers to have direct unsupervised contact with students, that they would have a develop a policy that would require a background check. We worked hard to make this as least prescriptive as possible, to give districts as much flexibility with what their needs are, and to not create an undue burden. I actually worked with Representative Hernandez's office quite a bit to develop a bill that, if in particular in his district, as I understand it, they do not allow direct unsupervised contact by volunteers. So there's no reason for them to have a policy. So the bill is written specifically that if they allow this circumstance, then they must develop a policy that requires a background check. That simply is what this bill is about, try to create as much of a safe environment for children as we can.
Great. Thank you very much. Colleagues, any question? Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And Krista, if I could shift back to you for a bill summary, please.
Yes.
Although
sure.
I think Representative Noble did a fine job in explaining it to us.
He did do a fine job. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the bill requires public schools or public charter schools and permits private schools to adopt and implement a policy to require volunteers to undergo a background check. The bill has an indeterminate fiscal impact. However, the impact to school districts is likely minimal because most are already indicating that they do background checks. There's an indeterminate fiscal impact to the Department of Education. However, we are going to include $442,500 in other funds expenditure limitation in Senate Bill 5516, which is the Department of Education budget bill, to account for the potential increase in criminal background checks that can be conducted under ORS 181A-195.
Okay, now there are no other witnesses signed up to testify for this bill, but one quick call. Any other? Is anyone else so moved? Okay, we are in a public hearing and work session, so let's go ahead and move into the work section with your first recommendation.
Okay, LFO recommends adoption of the A3 amendment, which expands existing school volunteer and employment background check law to permit the option of a nationwide criminal records check conducted by the Department of Education.
Okay. And Madam Co-Chair, I move adoption of the A3 amendment to House Bill 2992.
Senator Monroe has moved adoption of the dash A3 amendment to House Bill 2992. Any discussion?
Sure.
Any objection?
Thanks.
So moved.
And Madam Co-Chair, I move House Bill 2992 as amended to the full Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Monroe has moved House Bill 2992 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So moved. Okay, carriers.
Senator Thompson.
Senator Thompson to the full.
Full and to the Senate floor.
Or maybe, and we'll double check if there's any sponsors, because I noticed, are you one of the sponsors?
That's fine.
Okay.
If somebody's
and
sponsored.
I would say Representative Noble for the House. Yeah. I had the bill open and now I can't find it, of course. Okay. And with that, I'll close the public hearing and the work session. Let's see. Gelser and Canope. Okay, colleagues, the last item on our agenda, we will open a work session on Senate Bill 5525, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission fee bill.
Madam Chair, members, this should be quick. This is a fee ratification bill, which means you sort of approve something after it happens. But if this bill does not pass, the fee returns to what it was or goes away. This fee deals with career schools in Oregon. And for their review and approval of a new program at the school, the fee is set at $1,000. It was authorized 2 years ago in Senate Bill 218. The estimated revenues from this fee are $32,000 per biennium, which is assumed in the budget that you just passed.
Okay, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wilson, what was the fee, and is there opposition from the private schools?
My understanding is that this is a new fee that was established, so it would be zero was the old fee. And I do not believe or have heard, and heck is shaking their head no, that there is no opposition to it.
Thank you.
Senator Thompson.
Curious, what kind of time and work goes into reviewing? I mean, what do they get for their $1,000?
Is there anybody from HEC who might be able to answer that?
And were they paying for it before?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Senator Thompson, the HEC review is guided by the statutory requirements for review and approval of new programs at private career schools. It's a several month long process of staff ensuring that the program as described by the school meets the standards that are established under law and rule. I can follow up with more specific details. And in some cases, this gets down to a level of a sort of curricular review to ensure the quality and integrity of the program. But there are a sort of host of state standards that we oversee and that we review schools to ensure that they're meeting.
Thank you. And as Representative Parrish noted, how was this done before? Has it been done just without any fee support? Have we not approved it at the HEC level? Is this part of the transition from the system?
Yeah, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Representative Parrish, members, yes, the standards themselves and the review is not new. It was not previously funded, and as a result, this unit historically ran a deficit. It was not sort of a self-funding unit. That actually still is the case, even with the imposition of this new fee. We did work with the private career schools at the time before the adoption of Senate Bill 218 to develop a fee schedule that more accurately reflected the work that the unit does. And career schools generally, through the advisory committee that we work with, were supportive of establishing this fee in order to ensure that our reviews were funded, could be conducted well. I mean, they have significant interest, the schools themselves, in ensuring that this work is done in a high quality way, in a timely way. We inherited when this authority was assumed within the HEC, we inherited a significant backlog of reviews. So this fee has helped, and this funding has helped to get us through that and ensure that we're doing this work in a timely way.
Please, Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Is it a comparable process for public universities? And if so, how does that pay for?
Representative Parrish, co-chairs, members of the committee, we do review and approve new programs or new degrees at public universities and public community colleges. Interestingly, the standards for those reviews are very different. They're less prescriptive, more open-ended. I think the law and our administrative rule around the private non-exempt institutions, both degree granting and non-degree granting, is much more specific and rigorous about the types of assurances that those schools are required to provide to the state before we approve a new program. The funding for our degree approval and program approval, I should say, on the college and university side is through the basic state operating general fund operating budget that you just advanced for the HEC. So we do have parts of a couple of positions within the agency, several positions within the agency that are dedicated to doing that program review and approval for the public universities and community colleges.
That's sufficient.
One last follow-up. I know we all have other places to get to after this committee. So if you've got a public university and private university, and the private is held to a higher standard of rigor for what you're going to look at in terms of adopting their curriculum, so say an MBA at Merrillhurst versus an MBA at Portland State, I mean, how do you reconcile that to students who want to understand the value of their degree?
Representative Parrish, members of the committee, it's an interesting question. Just one note, Merrillhurst and other independent colleges are exempt from this oversight authority. So the kind of review authority that's described in Senate Bill 5525 that applies to private career schools does not apply, and similar standards apply to some degree-granting schools as well. But Merrillhurst and other nonprofit, long-time sort of historic colleges and universities in Oregon, private colleges and universities in Oregon are exempt. But nevertheless, your question is a good one. I think the assumption, and it's really a legislative one because it derives from statute, is that our public colleges and universities have themselves public boards, right? Either governor appointed on the university side and Senate confirmed, or elected in the case of our community college boards, that are the primary, hold the primary responsibility for ensuring that the quality, integrity, rigor of the new programs is ensured. And so their adoption precedes the state review. So the state review, the review that we conduct, is not as, let's say, onerous as I described. There are not as many standards that we apply. Our interest as a coordinating commission is primarily to ensure that the program that's brought forward is coordinated with other public offerings in the state of Oregon. So we're not seeing over sort of duplication of public programs. So we don't do the same level of rigor around the quality, the curriculum, et cetera, as we do on the private side, where there isn't a public board overseeing those institutions. We do look really more at the coordination question on the publics.
Opened up one more question. Okay. Sorry.
Briefly, please.
So if they're a private school, like a technical school, that also qualifies, like, you know, with the federal government for financial aid or any of those things, I mean, is that not the, are the federal government not doing any of that work in terms of establishing them as a, you know, I know that there are some who've gotten financial aid and then have not been so great, but I mean, is that our role or is that the federal government's role? I mean, how do you reconcile that work that's happening if the federal government says, well, we're going to let you charge financial aid and we think you're, you know, what's the difference between Oregon and the feds?
Representative Parrish, members of the committee, I'm sensing the opportunity for a hearing on this, and it's a great question. The federal government's oversight relative to its financial aid system relies primarily on accreditation. So these sort of third-party organizations that the federal government, in effect, and this isn't in the law, but in effect sort of outsources the quality control process to accreditors, an approved list of federally approved list of accreditors, and assuming that a school, private or public, maintains good standing with that accreditation agency, the school's students remain eligible for federal financial aid. So it's really a regulatory triad of federal government, accreditation agencies, and the state that ensure the quality of and coordination of our higher education offerings.
And Madam Co-Chair, are you ready for a motion?
Yes.
I would move Senate Bill 5525 to the full Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
All right, sorry, I was looking at the wrong screen. Thank you, Senator Monroe. Senator Monroe has moved Senate Bill 5525 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Any objection? So moved. And with that, oh, sorry, I need carriers.
Co-Chair Arnie, you want this one?
That's fine.
Roebland to the full and to the Senate.
Lively, do you want to? How about John Lively to the House?
I love to carry fee increases.
Just to confuse people.
It's not an increase. They've been
with
banned.
That, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 5525. And colleagues, we are scheduled for tomorrow. We will keep you posted on further scheduling, on whether we're done or whether we're continuing to meet. And with that, meeting is adjourned. Meeting is adjourned.